Our guest is the author of a landmark review calling for transformational change in our economic approach to nature. Professor Sripatha Dasgupta is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Cambridge and Chair of the Management Board of its Centre for the Study of Existential Risk. His research over the past 50 years has anticipated so many of our most pressing contemporary issues, redefining wealth to take account of natural and other forms of capital, the role of malnutrition as a poverty trap, optimal human population levels, and the intergenerational consequences of current actions. He was publishing on sustainable development before the term was in wide use. Sripatha was appointed by the British Chancellor of the Exchequer to lead an independent global review to assess the economic benefits of biodiversity and the economic costs of its loss. That review, released earlier this month, finds prosperity has come at a devastating cost to the natural world. Sripatha says nature must be recognised as an asset and that our traditional measure of economic prosperity, gross domestic product or GDP, is no longer fit for purpose. Sripatha Dasgupta is with us from the UK via Skype. Welcome back to 9 to Noon and thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure to be with you here.
Could you explain a little more about what you were tasked with doing by the Chancellor of the Exchequer and how you've gone about it?
Well, it was a surprise that the Ministry of Finance would be asking me to prepare a report on what would seem to be outside the remit of the finance ministry, but of course, he was exactly right. For too long, nature has been kept out of economic calculations, for the most part. Finance ministries, when they evaluate project or appraise projects, don't take natural resources into account unless they've actually paid for it. And since much of nature is free for use, it gets overlooked. So I was asked to prepare a review of the economics of biodiversity being an overarching notion which characterizes the features of certain features of ecosystems and therefore the biosphere as a whole. And the idea, I suspect he had it in mind, that I would restructure economics to make bring nature into it in a significant way. And that's what the review does.
If we come to the main findings, can we first look at what was and is the scale of the risk to nature and the natural world and biodiversity identified in the review? Just how bad have things got over the last half century?
Okay, that's a fair question. It's interesting to realize that all the evidence that comes from not just economics, but from the earth sciences, the ecological sciences, and then economics, tells us that the overreach that humanity has inflicted on the demands, in terms of the demands we make on the biosphere, is really rather recent. I mean, we are looking at about 40, 50 years or so, or put it this way, since this end of the Second World War. So we are looking at a new phenomenon at the global level, and which is why some scientists call this period, the post-war period, a new era, the Anthropocene. It's not a happenstance that they do. The idea really is that Mother Nature offers a whole bundle of goods and services, some of which we can observe, many of which we can't see even. For example, what happens under our feet in the soils. And the question is the demand we make of it, of these services, in line with what the biosphere is able to, or Mother Nature is able to supply on a sustainable basis? And over the past few decades, we have overreached it. Namely, we take more out than it can replenish, which means, of course, the quality of the biosphere is degrading. And how, you ask, how large is the gap? Well, some very, very crude estimates, and these estimates by the nature of the beast are very crude because we are new to this area of discourse. We would need about 1.6 Earths today to meet our demand on a sustainable basis. So if you like, it's a ratio of 1.6 to 1, and that's pretty large. If we carry on this route way, then of course we're going to hit into a whole sequence of problems, which we can't quite, we can't tell when. We are in fact probably breaching quite a number of them, one of them being climate regulation, as you, but climate change is one manifestation of the breakdown of the biosphere. So yes, it's pretty serious globally. But before you move to any other further question, do bear in mind that we have experience of the breakdown of ecosystems at the local level. We, you in New Zealand, I in UK, don't observe it, but the poorest parts of the world, in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, small communities have lost out in that they've eroded their local natural resource base, and some of the migration, the distress migration that we see now on our TV sets these days, in the news programs, are a reflection of it. So yes, we are overstretching, both locally at some parts of the world and globally.
Our industrial practices are part particularly of the climate regulation issues, our modern transport, many of our great technological advances, frankly, we're seeing the unintended consequences of. The main drivers of this extraordinary species loss in the last 50 years, an almost 70% decline in the populations of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, amphibians, is this simply resource extraction, destruction of habitat? What are the main activities that tell that story?
Land use change, for the most part. One way of unraveling the question that you're just now asked, and it's a very good question, is that one classification of the kinds of services that Mother Nature gives us, one particular classification scheme, sees it as comprising, broadly speaking, in three types. One, which people call provisioning services, and they include food, timber, water, fibers. And these are the objects that we are particularly interested in, we humans, to on a daily basis, as you can see from what I'm cataloging, that is food, water, and so forth. But then there is another class of services, which often we, in many cases, we can't see or even hear. And those are those climate regulation, cleansing of water, the services that wetlands provide, the peatlands provide, and so forth, and climate regulation, nitrogen fixation. There's just a whole swath of services which are silently taking place and are furnishing, providing the furniture for the provisioning services that I started with. And then, of course, there's a third, which is cultural, and I'll come back to that if we have time. Now, the problem is that we are interested in the provisioning services, and that competes with the other services, the silent services that I've just now mentioned. And land use change is a trigger mechanism for this conversion. We extend our farmlands and thereby cut into the capacity of the biosphere to provide the provisioning services and the maintenance services. But the maintenance and provisioning services, these abstract ones, the ones which are very often not really felt that closely, are the ones which are the bedrock of our life support system. So it's land use change, mining, agricultural extensions, and of course, dumping stuff back into the biosphere for it to clean up. We're doing too much of it. That is to say, it doesn't have the absorptive capacity for the dump, the garbage that we throw into it. And the garbage includes, by the way, carbon emissions. You should see that as a waste disposal mechanism. And the disposal unit is the atmosphere. That's one example. But of course, there are many, many other examples. Poisons that we emit from the factories and the commodities that we consume and then throw away as waste. Plastics, for example, has recently received quite a lot of attention for right reason. So it is land, let's call it land use change, the perturbation we are making to the biosphere. Land use change involves a great deal of killing of life, many of the organisms are invisible. They're too tiny, if nothing else, bacteria, and then so forth. So yes, that's the way I would put it. It would be, broadly speaking, land use change.
If we are making the case for change for humans' own benefit, clearly a lot of the natural world has paid a price for our superiority and in many cases our need, short-term approach to need. If you're making the case to humans, how do you make the case that this is going and is already costing us as a species? How have you made the case for there is a price that humans will and are paying for this? What is that price?
It's an ongoing price. The way you tell the story is that we feel it's absolutely reasonable that we pay when we leave the supermarket with the goods at the counter, checkout counter. We don't quarrel over it. We were not obliged to enter, but if you take things from there, you pay the price that's charged. Mother Nature is not charging for its services. And so we're not paying for it. Now, she wouldn't put mine to her. It's not a question of her paying back. But the thing is that because our demands, as a humanity's demands in the distant past, was rather small, it didn't matter that they weren't paying because the supply was sufficiently large. It was all as though it was infinitely large. But human numbers have grown. Our ingenuity has allowed us to introduce technological innovations so that we can take resources out from the earth and convert it into goods and services. So our demands have just cumulatively increased. And we're not continuing not to pay for many of these services. And that's the problem. Now, if we are told that it's not a free good because it's finite amount, so by scarcity means that there has to be some price. And you, of course, you don't pay the price to nature per se because there isn't a recipient there. What you do is to pretend that you need to pay a price, so you husband it. You husband it by noticing that it's of limited supply. And there are ways of doing it. We do that all the time. For example, suppose there is a sacred grove. Communities have sacred groves. Now, you don't touch it. That's prohibited by the culture. So it's almost like saying it's an infinite price. Now, you're actually not paying anybody, but you're husbanding it here very dramatically by actually not tampering with it at all, the sacred grove. And then, of course, you come to the more conventional types of natural capital, wetlands and so forth. They may be free, the services are free, but you want to restrict use of it because otherwise it will disappear. And if it disappears, then in future, that service won't be there and you'll be paying a price. So it's really a transfer of consumption from today to tomorrow. And if you consume too much today, you'll pay the price by having less access to goods and services in the future. Or you, it may not be you, it'll be our children, grandchildren, and so forth.
This is multidisciplinary.
And I think that's the only way to convey the idea.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, no, I understand it. It's multidisciplinary. I want to make this point. You're speaking as an economist and you have been hired by the head of a treasury to do this work. It is multidisciplinary. The ecologists I know you work closely with, there are cultural components you've pointed out. There are ethical components to this. But when you are speaking the language to governments and to major institutional investors and other very, very powerful determinants of action, the economics speaks. To some of what you've been talking about, we have this concept of depreciation of assets and pre-funding of depreciation of assets in the business world. Is there a slight difference with the natural assets? Not only don't we do that depreciation, but when they're gone, many of them are gone, and the complexity of their interrelationships, you just can't put a new building here or replace that truck here when you've stuffed your climate, please excuse me. So if we come to framing this as an economic rationale, how have you done that in the report?
We've done that by regarding nature as an asset, unarguably our most precious asset, because without it, we're not going to be here. We are part of it. It's our home. That said, you need to decompose this asset into its various ecosystems, if you like, various bits and pieces. So different types of ecosystems are different assets. The review takes the ecosystems as a central organizing idea of an asset. And within an ecosystem would be all sorts of sub-assets, if you like. So yeah, that's where the biodiversity comes in. And you're looking at ecosystems as a source of services and goods that we can enjoy. So because it's missing from our normal economic calculation, doesn't make these assets uneconomical or non-economic. Economics, remember, is a discipline which is embedded in our normative language. We value goods as we see them in our value system. We mustn't think that the market is the only way of arriving at prices or values. It's one set of institutions which delivers a certain, a particular manifestation of our values. So it's to say that if you want to think about the biosphere and what it does for us, you're moving out of economics. That would be a wrong move, intellectual move, because economics is a set of tools for us to organize our life. And that includes our attitude to life, the kind of life we want to lead, and the way we want to share the benefits and burdens of communal living. So the review takes the attitude that a whole category of assets, durable goods assets, have been missing in our economic calculations. So we ought to bring them in. And once you bring them in, then what results is economics. So it's not as though it's foreign. Natural capital or nature is foreign to ministries of finance or central banks. They're foreign only because they chose to make nature foreign. It was a decision. It's not a Platonic ideal by any stretch. So the review is very much a reconstruction of economics. It's almost like having a family in which you didn't recognize that there was somebody who was actually a member of the family, but you hadn't noticed it, and he or she lives outside the family. Once you bring that person in and say, this is part of my family, then that's your family.
Professor Supatha Das Gupta.
It's a redefinition, reconstruction of your family.
Yes. Professor Supatha Das Gupta is our guest. He has delivered this report that was requested for the British Chancellor of the Exchequer on the natural world, the loss of biodiversity and other inflictions we have made on our environment. It's 26 minutes past 10 on 9 to noon. Can we look then at how you are reimagining how we value, literally value, these services and how we might reflect that in our big measures that determine so much? And let's start with GDP. I think even the creator of GDP as a measure, if I'm correct, it was the economist Simon Kuznets, recognised its limitations and perverse incentives, and yet it remains central to governmental and national accounting. What do you propose happens to these big measures that governments, central banks, investors and voters use to assess and value things?
Well, it hit upon a sort of sensitive chord here. The GDP was not meant for the use to which it's been put in recent decades. It's invaluable for short-run macroeconomic management because you need a measure of economic activity, and you needed it very badly at a time when something like 25% of the economy was in spare capacity of the factories or 25% or so of unemployment. You needed to boost the economic activity, and you needed a measure of economic activity, and GDP does that. The problem is that after the war, somehow it got transformed into an index of success, economic success. So you thought the idea was to say that if GDP increases, it must reflect a betterment of the human condition in the society that you're concerned with. The problem with GDP is, of course, that it doesn't include the depreciation of capital. And one of the features of natural capital or nature, which is sort of somewhat different from buildings and durable goods like buildings and roads, is that you can really depreciate it very fast. Now, we could depreciate buildings very fast, too, if we chose to, and they do get depreciated if there's a war. But since we don't think in terms of war as being a natural state of affairs, we feel, well, what we do, these buildings are pretty durable. We keep about 4-5%, for example, as a depreciation allowance. But when it comes to natural capital, the examples that we discussed a few minutes ago, you can actually completely wipe out natural capital pretty fast, as, for example, you do when you wipe out bits and pieces of the, and more than bits and pieces of the tropical rainforest and convert them into farmland, ranches, or whatever. Okay, so you need a measure, just like private companies have balance sheets, not just income and expenditure statements. Nations need balance sheets. And what the review recommends is to move to a system of accounts which includes the measurement of the assets. So the wealth of a nation is as contrasted to GDP of a nation, is like the balance sheet of the nation. If over time your balance sheet expands, it becomes larger, you're saying you're wealthier. And that conforms to some notions of well-being, as, for example, in your well-being budget and living standards measures in New Zealand. I'm not an expert of it, but you're moving in that direction. And the idea is to look at the way your stocks are changing, stocks of assets. And wealth is a way of combining the stocks into a manageable number.
Another recommendation, could you speak to it, please, is ways of increasing public and private financial flows that enhance natural assets, decrease those that degrade nature. Are we turning to tools like subsidies and pollution taxes? Are we using traditional tools to try and incentivise that, or are there new tools you recommend?
Well, the review goes into the tools that are available in great detail. But first of all, not all the problems should be met by government. They're not in the remit of government. Communities also matter. A great number of problems that arise in our treatment of nature happens at a local level. And so the review thinks not only of communities and markets and households, but also not only government, markets and household, but communities or civil society, if you like, in a more general sense, as mediators, as institutions within which our economic life sits. Now, you will need taxes. You need also agreements within groups. And if you study the economics of poor countries, you will find that a great deal of activity takes place outside the state's remit. It takes place within communities, exchanges taking place all the time. But we tend, on the whole, in the modern world, to subsidize the use of natural capital. We began this discourse by noting that so much of natural capital is free. Nature's goods and services are free. In fact, the price is often negative because governments subsidize the use of natural capital, energy subsidies, water subsidies, you name it, fertilizer subsidies, and so forth. To the extent that it's now about 4-5% of global GDP is in the form of subsidy. Now, that's absolutely outrageous. You're not only regarding nature to be valueless, but you're saying that it's actually a pest. That needs to be, you're paying yourself to take to destroy it. So one category of policies that emerge from them is to lift these subsidies out. Now, of course, that's easier said than done, as we know. There are lobbies, there'll be vested interest. You've enjoyed subsidies for years, you're not going to give it up. But these are problems that we really need to face. And of course, there are, as you say, there are taxes but that you can use. But let me give you a final example, which will tell you how the review treats natural capital. Take the high seas. Now, the high seas belong to nobody, but they're a finite resource. There's an enormous amount of services that the oceans provide. The whole climate system is mediated by the oceans as a large, huge asset. And we are using it for transport, not just cruises, but also transport of all goods and services, these big containers that move along. And of course, it's also a source of fish. But now nobody pays a rent for it because it's nobody's property. And yet it's a massive public good. So one possibility would be for humanity to the world, the governments, to create a transnational institution which is responsible for monitoring, even imposing taxes for its use. We wouldn't call it tax, you just call it a rent. It's like transport. If you use the train or the roads, somebody is paying for it. Here also, you need a rent. You need to impose a rent. Now, so there'll be a huge amount of money that we can actually, the world economy can actually collect by doing that. And of course, that'll ease the pressure on the oceans because it then now becomes more expensive to use. That kind of money could be used for another set of public goods. For example, the tropical rainforests, which are also public goods because they're seats of carbon, huge seats of carbon, and are affecting the climate system. On the other hand, they're public goods, but they are within national jurisdiction. So you've got a mismatch here. The incentive on the nation may be to cut it down and transform them into ranches, but the globe as a whole, humanity as a whole, would say, no, you must control that. Now, how do you do that? Way to do it would be to pay for that service. So they would be like stewards of a public good. And you could use the revenue that you generate from the high seas, the rents collected from that, to subsidize the protection and preservation and restoration of these public goods, which are within jurisdictions of nations. So there's a lot of interesting economics that can be created once the moment you recognize that you've got this amazing asset in which we happen to live and we're part of, which we have been trashing because we have pretended that they don't exist.
Supatha, I know there's many, many elements to the report's recommendations. I know there's a big emphasis on education, especially finance and education. But if you are looking at a move at scale, do you believe we need some kind of cooperation akin to the Climate Paris Agreement? Could existing institutions be part of the kind of global cooperation you're talking about? Is that needed and is it likely to happen?
Well, it's likely to happen. How likely it is to happen depends on how urgent we believe this problem is and how serious it is. After all, we remember none of these problems, they're cousins to these problems we've already faced. At the end of the Second World War, there was an enormous need for reconstruction of Europe. And there was a Marshall Plan. That was motivated from, it was at a national level, that's for sure. But pretty soon, the agreement was to create the World Bank. And it's called actually the International Bank for Reconstruction and development. IMF, the International Monetary Fund, WHO, which is concerned with health. Now, these institutions were created to face, to supply certain public goods. In the case of the IMF, for example, it would be like an insurance scheme at the macroeconomic level for countries to make use of in case they run into serious monetary problems. Okay, so we are used to creating such institutions. They are not alien to the human condition. And the example I just now gave for the need for multinational institutions, transnational institutions, which could husband, which could keep an eye on that part of the those parts of the biosphere which are public goods, they should be in charge of that. Now it's not an outrageous idea at all. It's a natural outcome of the thought that there are these huge public goods that we are enjoying, but which we don't have any mechanism for handling. And in the climate case, that example, the atmosphere is a public good. It's a global public good. And one possibility would have been to have an international institution, transnational institution, charging rents for the emissions. But we've chosen a different way. Countries are one way or the other to limit their emissions. That's the agreement. The Paris Agreement has to do with limits. And those limits were reached from a rather simpler calculation, which is how far mean global temperature increase are you willing to tolerate? And if you have 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees maximum increase from since pre-industrial times, you can work back from that, from climate models, what emissions should be permitted, the limits to the emissions. And then from that, economists can work out in principle what taxes to charge for it. Now, many countries, actually, there are no taxes. So they failed on that. Paris hasn't been exactly a resounding success. But one advantage of thinking of the biosphere not solely in terms of climate is that there are some emotional connection to the biosphere which are not mediated by climate. It has to do with what we see around us, the animals, the birds, the bees, the insects, and the life that's humming out there. And I think in some sense we can see the sacredness of it. In every culture, there is a sense in which in our more sober moments, we realize that there is something sacred out there.
Thank you, Sir Pata.
Exploit
that emotion. We'll do it at all levels. I really appreciate your time again. It's greatly appreciated. Professor Sir Pata Dasgupta on his report recently released to the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, who had commissioned it.